Running an online business is hard enough without the stress and time consumption of managing hosting. Whether managing one WordPress site or dozens, Kinsta's managed solutions offer speed, enterprise-grade security, and an intuitive dashboard. With 24/7, 365 human-only expert support, get peace of mind that your sites stay online, secure, and performing their best. Start today and get your first month free with migrations handled for you. Learn more at kinsta.com/podcast. That's kinsta.com/podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, everybody. It is our second week of season two of video episodes. How are you doing, Alex?
Good. Not too bad. Good to see you. And again, as a reminder to anyone listening to us on any platform, if you do switch over to us on YouTube, On Air with Dan and Alex, you can now see us in vision. I'm seeing Dan appear to be in London. He's just going to be throwing us off wherever he is each and every week with these weird wildcard virtual backgrounds. But yeah, all good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm just trying to figure out we're realizing that there are some things that are very complicated about this new recording setup, like what to do about, I have one big microphone here that's being hidden by the background, and then I have a small one that I'm trying to record on. So we're doing many different things at once, but I'm excited because I've been a YouTuber for 15 years and I have a new challenge. So.
Yeah. And I seem to rack up a good load of comments in the previous episode of people wondering not about British Airways status, not about the substance that we were discussing, but rather why has Alex got one earphone in and one AirPod in? Seem to be the focus. Let me just quickly clear it up. In this ear, I can hear the joint feed of both of us. And in this ear, I can hear only Dan. So at least I can hear kind of how the show sounds together. And then only Dan's ear. Can you imagine? Two lots of Dan, one in each ear. I'm happy you agree. Anyway, listen, I wanted to ask you about your video, right? Because I, along with tens of thousands of others, watched your latest video where you were talking about your love for Finnair. Shock. Nothing that will come as a surprise to any listener. I mean, I know the video wasn't sponsored, right? But I wanted to know why it felt a little like it's a, but you're very, very objective in some videos. And in this video, I mean, Dan, that was a Finnair love fest.
Yeah. Good question. So I was thinking about this a little bit, why there's some airlines that I just want to praise, even though I have no reason to. Like, it's not like I'm getting anything. Okay. I remembered that back in the day, especially before COVID, I used to feel the same about Qatar during the blockade, because it's kind of like we talk about with some airlines being underdogs, especially airlines that you like when they have the odds stacked against them. So Finnair now has, you know, not being able to use Russian airspace, which is obviously a huge deal for them. So
you feel sorry for them.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's selfish because I want to enjoy Finnair as it is for as long as possible. But if their finances don't get better, or if they don't get more profitable, they're going to cost cut. So my selfish reason is that I need to make as many people as possible fly the airlines that I like, that I'm concerned about, so that they don't cost cut and they can remain that way, because I'm always stressing out. We've seen airlines that were once great, even 5 years ago, descend into something that's not as great. So I'm just like, come on, I'm doing the work for my future self, for my family. We need to have people flying Finnair.
That is just not the answer I expected. So you're making a video that is essentially borderline advert on your own accord.
Exactly.
With your own motivations to ensure potential future profitability of an airline with struggling financials, so that you can continue to fly them in the state that they are, and they don't, for example, cut the meal size, which I know that you noted. And I mean, now that it makes sense, the video makes sense. It was full of little comments of like, oh, and I love this, but I hope this stays. Oh, and this is great, but please don't cut that. I mean, that was a There was a load of trauma up there in those comments.
Yeah, you figured it out. So that's the thing. I just selfishly, with no, you know, thought about the airline, really want things to remain good. And of course, I'm overestimating the impact I have
big
on
time.
Finnair's bottom line. But even if I can get two people to book Finnair Business because of me and then enjoy it and then recommend it to others, then I'm good. And it's always just with airlines that I really enjoy, but I feel, you know, it's like I said with Qatar during the blockade, that they really had the odds stacked against them. So I was like, okay, come on, like, let's encourage more people to try them so that they have better odds of not having to remove what I like, you know?
Well, I mean, look, I think leave the richest country in the world to one side. I think they were fine without you having to drum up support in 2017. I'm sure they appreciate that as a gesture, though. But for Finnair, I think our conclusion before we move on is that you care more about Finnair's financial bottom line than Finnair does. And that is evident in their upcoming quarter four results for 2024. But look, let's get to it. There's a lot that we have on today's agenda. There's been quite a lot happening. We didn't discuss it yet during the week when you and I speak between episodes, which now we tend not to do very much because we just save up a whole conversation to have with everyone else, because we think, what's a phone call when it can be shared with tens of thousands of friends? But the 777X, right, is the, when we were discussing about 2025, this is the Boeing flagship that's coming up that will be the next newish plane. When I say newish, because it is an existing 777, but it's modified, extended, and it's a new, ultimately, version slash variant of the 777 family, the 777X. This is an aircraft that was supposed to enter service years ago, and it's really, really suffered with delays, and we've covered this on the podcast before. In August 2024, we discussed how they had suspended all test flights. So the aircraft is still in the production phase, and they are now in post-production in the flight test campaign period, which is where they test aircraft in terms of its flying capabilities. They put it through an extensive test flight procedure. It takes place over weeks and months. That was all suspended in August after Boeing had discovered cracks in the thrust links. Now, thrust links, and I think we discussed this speaking super simple, it's basically the component that connects the engines with the aircraft wings, right? So it's if you like, the engine holder attachment in simple speak, okay? That you can identify if you're looking at a normal aircraft. The cracks were identified only during routine maintenance, which is, you know, something that is ongoing even for new aircraft. And they were found across multiple aircraft, which triggered that grounding. So for an aircraft that should have entered service so many years ago, we're now, 5 years late since it's entered service, the actual test flights have been grounded. They have now resumed. So finally, some 5-6 months later, Boeing, since we last spoke, have given the green light for those aircraft to resume test flights so that Boeing can eventually start delivering these aircraft pending all those certifications, which is now scheduled for 2026, some 6 years late. My question to you is, if Boeing are already grounding these brand new aircraft before a delivery has even commenced, does it give you much confidence as someone who jumps on new aircraft and is looking for the next big YouTube video to jump on the first lot of 777Xs when they are finally delivered to whoever becomes the launch customer?
Hey, listen, the odds are you will be on a 777X from Qatar Airways before I am ever on one. But then my thought is...
Why do you say that? Why? Because just because it's set to go to Qatar, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you are spend a lot of time in Doha, so it wouldn't be surprising. But I will say this, even I, and I'm much less cautious than you, was like, first of all, the 777X fleet will be much smaller than the 737 MAX fleet. So if something were to go wrong, you know, it's going to happen. The odds are bigger because there will be fewer Okay, that's a weird way of phrasing it. But you being on a 777X, if there's something wrong with that aircraft, there's less 777X to spread it out over. I also feel like at this point...
So basically, that's like easier to avoid what you're saying.
Yeah, kind of. But at this point, I just don't trust Boeing. Like, legitimately, at what point of this aircraft having been flying around? Because let's say they deliver a dozen or whatever in the first year of operations, maybe two dozen at most. Still, it's such a small sample and you never know what could go wrong. So, yeah, it is not something I'm like, yeah, I would just love to jump on a 777X. Not to mention, you say it's 6 years delayed at this point. I'm reading over some of the stats about it. A 10% fuel improvement for an aircraft that is now 6 years delayed from when it was supposed to enter service. I'm like, this isn't even, we should be beyond 10% savings compared to a 777-300 at this point.
No, you're completely right. In fact, you know, this is an aircraft that the way in which technology has evolved and moved on just in the last 6 years alone, let alone when this aircraft first went into production and was, you know, put up on the drawing board, the world has changed. And I think it's so easy to get caught up that we feel in aviation they're making massive strides in technology and innovation. And sometimes you get that harsh reminder where it's like, no, you know, the next big thing, the 777X is going to have a whopping 10% fuel saving.
Yeah.
That's the innovation. Oh, and don't forget the fact that, you know, the wings have that, folding
wingtip.
Winglets. Yeah. In order to, the folding wingtips in order to be able to fit at gates that are not currently able to accommodate an aircraft that size. It's unusual. But the reason I wanted to raise this is because we would never have had these questions about over safety of brand new aircraft had Boeing had not gone through everything that Boeing has gone through. And it's just funny how, you know, previously the likes of a brand new aircraft coming up for you and I, we'd be following every development, you know, we'd probably want to be right there at the delivery, probably beyond the delivery and things like that. And now it's a bit like, oh, but there was so much that they found out about the 737 MAX after that aircraft came into service, tragically losing hundreds and hundreds of lives during the learning process when they figured out there was something fundamentally wrong. If Boeing are already grounding this aircraft in its test capacity, what happens when this ever enters service? And let's see if it enters in 2026. As a reminder, who's getting this aircraft, right? The biggest real customers are Emirates, Qatar, Lufthansa, ANA, and a few others.
British Airways,
British Airways, yeah. Yes, true. Most of the airline execs that I speak to off the record about the 777X are frustrated with how stupidly delayed it is. But they also now, it's almost become so bad over at Boeing that it's just like, let them get on with it. It's not like normal where airlines will be picking up the phone and demanding answers as to why an aircraft is late. They know why the aircraft is late. You only have to turn on CNN to see why the aircraft is late.
Yeah.
And the only thing I will say is that this isn't spoken about much in aviation circles publicly, Boeing have had to spend a lot of money keeping airline customers quiet and happy. And I don't mean anything like a hush money payment, but in terms of the compensation that they are legitimately owed through their contractual agreements with the manufacturer because the aircraft is so late. So that's why, different to 10 years ago when the A350 delivery slipped a bit here and there and we'd see all the airline CEOs start speaking to Bloomberg and the Financial Times about how outrageous it was that they're not keeping their commitments. That's why we don't really see that in this scenario, because they're being fed with a lot of compensation.
And also, it's a bad look when the 737 MAX led to so many casualties to see airline CEOs trying to rush or stress an aircraft into service from the same manufacturer would just be a bad look, because we know safety needs to be the number one priority at this point, which is, of course, we always say that. That's what we always think. But with Boeing, that's genuinely the case now, because we know that what they've been building over the past decade hasn't been up to the standard that you would expect. Now, you know, we have 4 years coming up of another Trump presidency. So whatever happens with the 777X will be under him. So let's see what he does. He's made some comments about Boeing before. So I don't know what that will mean for the 777X, but
apparently he's furious that who's discovered that the new Air Force One aircraft, or I mean, they're not actually called Air Force One. Air Force One is a call sign, but let's just to simplify it, the aircraft that then becomes Air Force One that flies the president, he's discovered it's delayed to 2029. And, yeah, and apparently he's furious, and he held a call with Boeing last week, you know, asking WTF over this. So I think it will even be interesting to see, as you say, the shift between how Boeing handle all of this under a Trump presidency.
Yeah,
we've got some episodes you can go back to where we had the discussion over Trump calling Boeing batshit Boeing and blasting them for not re-engineering the 757, which he said was a beautiful
the praying mantis.
What was it? Praying mantis. Yeah, the that kind of big fly insect thing.
Okay,
looks like a grasshopper.
We're definitely in the era of re-engineering aircraft, because we've kind of reached the end of technological development in terms of the current shape of aircraft. But I just feel like re-engineering aircraft anymore is not the answer. A 767neo, 757neo, A350neo, which is may or may not be happening. It's just all these things that an aircraft was built for a specific model of engine. So let's not keep doing this, guys.
No, you're right. And it's funny because after the 777X, right, you know, all being well, all goes well, and you know, and hopefully everything's fine there. Then what?
Yeah.
I mean, what's so it will be like goodbye, my friend, to the A380. I mean, as we said last week, we better keep flying them, because I don't want to be in the place where we just remember them as a distant memory and remember when we used to go upstairs on an aircraft. Otherwise, it's going to be so boring.
I know.
So,
if we're going to have one more Neo, make it an A380. If there has to be one.
That is not coming. I mean, remember Airbus tried that, the A380 Plus and all these kind of different modifications, and it just didn't work. Well, look, you are sitting with a backdrop of good old London, England, on what looks like the only day that the sun comes out a year there. So I guess it's kind of like mid-July, where it goes from being freezing overnight to like the gates of hell, 40 degrees. But you are there because there is a reversal that affects quite a lot of international travelers that I think is really important that we touch on. So what's happened?
So did we discuss this last week about the ETA coming into effect? I can't remember. I don't think we did, but...
No, I don't think we did. Maybe it was on our list and we didn't get to it, but so I don't think we did.
The UK, for anyone who's missed it, has introduced a similar thing to the US version of ESTA. So the UK has introduced an ETA, which is an electronic travel authorization, which you need to apply for online before your trip to the UK. You should do it at least a few days before your trip. So right now it applies to anyone coming from a visa exempt countries outside the European Union. And then starting in April, but you can start applying from March 5th, it applies to people even from the European Union. So I actually tried to apply a few days ago because they're raising the price from 10 to 16 pounds soon. So I was like, might as well do it. And then I realized I can't as a Swede yet. But anyway, the point is,
okay,
you need to apply for this if you're not a UK citizen. But...
Right. So this comes into effect...
It came into effect January 8th. So it's been in effect for almost 2 weeks now. So the bizarre thing is that unlike most countries that require any form of visa or travel authorization, this also applied to transit passengers, people who weren't even entering the UK. They were just flying from Europe or from the Middle East to the US, for example. And obviously, that is a big part of especially British Airways business, transit passengers. So obviously, British Airways wasn't having a fun time the past week, where a lot of people showed up to the airport not realizing they needed to also think about the visa rules or entry rules for the UK. But I have to say, I'm impressed that British Airways has not issued a strongly worded statement about this. Luckily, I think they issued that directly to the government, because we now have some changes to this, right, Alex?
Yeah. So we have a complete U-turn, right? So the government has reversed its decision to require the electronic travel authorization, the ETA, the UK version of an ESTA, for passengers transiting through UK airports. quite right. I mean, they're literally not even entering there. It's your point of transit. If you are going to attract any business to for transit, why would I be searching through forms and online things to pay $10 or £10, whatever it is, per person for transit when I could just do the same via Amsterdam and not have any of that hassle? So the change, they say, now simplifies travel for non-visa nationals who previously faced additional administrative and financial burdens imposed by the very entity that is now reversing. So yeah, funny that they've kind of woken up and smelt the coffee. Obviously, there was criticism from the industry, and we know that BA have played a part in, you know, not just lobbying, but informing the government of the reality of such a decision. The flow via Heathrow for British Airways is British Airways' bread and butter, right? This is what makes them so profitable. It's not the point to point. And this is, they say now, part of a decision that is, you know, they're going to set the UK more on the competitive side versus their European airport counterparts, which of course is, well, I mean, a bit of a stretch, but yeah.
Yeah. You know, the thing that bothers me about this is that if Heathrow was the smoothest running airport in the world, it would be fine. But every single day, British Airways is pretty much forced to cancel a handful of flights for various reasons. Yeah. We know I've been, for some reason, 50% of my flights happen to be that handful of flights that gets canceled when I fly British Airways.
Yeah.
So for people who are just randomly transiting in the UK, let's say for the first time, and they have their connection canceled, let's say they're going from the US, connecting to somewhere in Europe, the flight from London to Europe onwards is canceled. Then if they land and they don't have the ETA, which from reports I've read is usually approved instantly, but just the idea that you could land, your new flight is tomorrow, or your new flight is in 12 hours, but you don't have authorization to leave Heathrow and enter the UK to go to a hotel or something because British Airways canceled your flight. That is a problem. Of course, that's the case in the US as well. But to me, that automatically makes the UK a much less appealing option for transit, even without a requirement for an ETA to transit, just because there's always the risk if you don't have the ETA, you haven't been there, that something will happen and you'll be in a nightmare situation because you're stuck at Heathrow.
Well, what does happen in that scenario? So let's just discuss that for a minute. So if a passenger doesn't have the ETA because you now no longer need it to transit, and then the flight is cancelled and rebooked for 12 hours later, but of course Heathrow closes at night, right? So you cannot be airside or even in the departures hall during the night. Usually the earliest those doors open is around 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. The earliest you can go airside, for example, in winter is about 5-ish. Sometimes it's even a bit later. The scenario then for that passenger who goes on to apply for an ETA, you know, out of necessity because they now need a hotel for the night or BA are going to put them up, and then they don't get that ETA, then what?
Yeah, I have no idea. This is a question we should try to find out the answer to, but it's definitely something to keep in mind. Of course, I would just say anyone who's listening and who has any plan to transit in the UK, just apply. At the end of the day, it's £10. It's like an insurance, making sure that if anything goes wrong, you'll be able to get in. It's valid for 2 years, as many entries as you want. So in that sense, I'd say the advice to give is just to apply. But inevitably, there will be people who are in the situation where they haven't applied. They landed Heathrow, and In a very rare situation, they'll be landing on an evening flight like you're describing, where there's not an onward connection until the next day. Not the best. But then again, I understand why the UK would introduce it at this point. Europe is introducing it, or the European Union is introducing it later this year as well. The US, of course, has had this for a very long time. So it's just, you know, reciprocity, basically.
And people complain about the fact that the US have gotten away with it for so long. So it's you know, something that the UK is doing to try to boost part of its flatlining economy.
Can we just say what's so wild about the US compared to any other country in the world is that even as a citizen landing in the US, they interrogate you as if it's like, as if there's an option they won't let you in. It's like, this is my home country. What am I supposed to do if you don't let me in? It's like, where have you been? What are you doing in the United States of America? I'm from the United States of America. So yeah, I just don't understand that, because anywhere else you go as a citizen, it's like, that's not part of the equation. But the US loves to make things stressful for everyone when it comes to travel. So
okay, another big shift in Europe, which is that Lufthansa, the Lufthansa group, has finally acquired Italian flag carrier ITA Airways. Buongiorno, benvenuto, because they are fully now on board the Lufthansa group train. It's a done deal. Lufthansa, formerly Dan's favorite airline, where he got his username from. He's Nonstop Dan. And if you
that
remember
is not
Lufthansa's
the reason.
Previous slogan, sorry, Mr. Co-host, I'm speaking. If you remember me, the guy who interrupts him constantly. the Nonstop, you Nonstop Dan airline has acquired a 41% stake in ITA Airways for €325 million, bargain, giving it a controlling interest of the airline. Of course, massive entry into the all-important and fast-growing Italian market, which has an incredibly lucrative domestic market, if only it could be financially sound, which Lufthansa is hoping to bring to the table. And ITA now becomes the newest member of the Lufthansa group. So it now joins the likes of actual Lufthansa, all of Lufthansa's 10,000 subsidiaries, CityLine, CityLink, blah, blah, blah. Also, Swiss. Thank you for flying Swiss with the cute little chocolates. Austrian, Brussels, Eurowings, and even Air Dolomiti. Before we go into this deal, right, you are the top of Lufthansa. You've just acquired the Italian flag carrier. You've got the controlling stake of 41%. It's likely that the stake is going to increase. But for now, the Ministry of Economy and Finance are keeping hold of the remaining percentage. Do you blend Air Dolomiti into the ITA Airways brand so that you don't have two Italian brands coexisting alongside each other? Well, because you're a Lufthansa and you love brands, so many brands, so many Lufthansa brands.
The most
do
brands.
Do you just keep them? The most brands. Seriously, make airline brands great again is the Lufthansa accurate slogan. Do you keep them alongside each other? What do you do, Dan?
First, I just have to correct some things. Lufthansa indeed was my favorite airline. I just have to confirm that back in the day when Alex and I met, Lufthansa was my favorite airline. But Nonstop Dan does not come from the Lufthansa slogan. It came to me entirely separately on a random walk through Bangkok in 2018. Now, let's go back to the topic at hand. Obviously, I would fold Air Dolomiti straight into ITA Airways because there's a certain point where you don't want, it's one thing to have a separate brand in each country that represents the country, Swiss, Austrian, Brussels. These carry the city or the country name for the country of the subsidiary. ITA Airways doesn't quite do that, but having Air Dolomiti alongside ITA Airways, but them essentially being the same airline, is just confusing. It's going to confuse passengers. It might even confuse regulators in Italy who probably don't have any idea what's going on. But yeah, honestly, fold it in. What do you think?
I have you flown Air Dolomiti?
I have. Not in business class, though.
why are you saying it like that? Is that because you're assuming my flight was... Yeah, it was. You're right. I was in the bulkhead in the front row. But no. So this is such a niche little airline. I mean, it's definitely not the little airline that could, but rather the little airline that kind of did by getting in the Lufthansa group. So it's... Oops, goodness, knocking my mic. I flew this Italian little airline brand on a route that didn't touch Italy whatsoever between Munich and Toulouse, because they do some of these very specific niche secondary third city, let's say, if you like.
Wow, just roast Toulouse. which is not in the south of France.
Munich to Toulouse, which is geographically located in the south of France.
If it was the south of France, it wouldn't be Air Dolomiti. That's why.
I would like to know where you think Toulouse is if it's not in the south.
It's
where
in
is
the
it?
Southern part of France, but not the south of, not the brand name south of France.
Just because you associate the south of France with Cannes and Antibes and Nice doesn't mean that Toulouse is the southern. Remove the urn and what do you have?
Wait,
exactly. Moving on. So I flew from Munich to Toulouse, which is a very heavy Airbus route for Airbus employees trying to go anywhere else other than Toulouse on work trips. And when they when I had flown that morning from Athens, I had a really early start, flew on the first flight from Athens about 5 a.m. with Aegean from Athens to Munich and then connecting Munich to Toulouse. One thing I feel slightly warm about this little airline is that I remember being asleep before takeoff, like just upright, kind of like leaning, and waking up on little Air Dolomiti where I didn't even know if, you know, there would be a glass of water. And I woke up with a blanket on me and a pillow, like just wedged in the tiny gap This is so sweet. And then when I woke up, she was like, good morning. She was like, we have your breakfast. And it was pancakes. And I was like, what is this airline? I was shocked. But yeah, it was a nice little experience. Why was I talking about Air Dolomiti? Right, what would I do? I don't know if I would be able to coexist the brand alongside ITA. I think you're right. I mean, is this a good deal for Italian consumers that the airline is going to be part of the Lufthansa group? I think we discussed it before. You and I feel a bit about it, because what it does for competition, it reduces the competitive landscape. It means that basically in Europe, you are flying Lufthansa or IAG.
Yeah.
And that's
Air France KLM. What are you talking about?
Forgot about them. I was just making sure you were listening. That's all.
I just have to say, I'm having a look here at the current Air Dolomiti aircraft in the air. And what happened to Air Dolomiti? Make Air Dolomiti great again, because they have four aircraft in the air at the moment, and it's 9 a.m. in Europe. Surely there should be more somewhere. We have one.
No, but they're so small.
But I thought they had like dozens of aircraft. They definitely don't have.
I see more than four. One, two, three, four, five, six.
In the air, in the air. I only
so what
see,
are the rest on the ground?
Yeah. So I see Frankfurt Turin, Amsterdam Munich, Frankfurt Wrocław, or however you say it in Poland, and Frankfurt Graz in Austria.
Gosh, and they're all late. All of them.
Of course, because it's Air Dolomiti. No, but the thing is...
stereotyping, not allowed. Go on.
The thing is, I'm surprised because... I thought Air Dolomiti was a Munich thing, but apparently since my days of flying Air Dolomiti...
That's what I'm looking at.
Yeah, since my days of flying Air Dolomiti, which was 2015, 2016, when they were the only airline operating on behalf of Lufthansa between Gothenburg and Munich, I just associated that with Munich. But I guess maybe this is part of Lufthansa's broader capacity shift that they keep doing back and forth between Munich and Frankfurt. And they're always unhappy with one of the airports. Right now, they're unhappy with Munich Airport because Munich Airport has been understaffed and caused a lot of their flights to be delayed. So perhaps this is some a remnant from when they were unhappy with Frankfurt. So they moved small capacity aircraft there and moved the bigger A320 family aircraft to Munich to operate to the likes of Toulouse and Gothenburg. More.
I think that's a good assessment.
Yeah. Anyway, random.
Decent assessment.
Random note on Air Dolomiti.
Random deep dive into Air Dolomiti.
I just want to say, I love how we've probably given more airtime to Air Dolomiti now than we do to some of the world's biggest airlines. Like, how much time do we spend on this podcast talking about Delta? But we're like, no, let's talk about Air Dolomiti.
I don't think we've ever spoken about Delta on this podcast. And they've done so many, they've made so many moves. Did you see the event they did in the Sphere in Vegas?
No, because I didn't.
What? This event was next level. I had major FOMO. Seriously, really? if Delta want us to discuss them on the podcast, they only had to have us there at the Sphere in Vegas for that event. It would have given us about 10 weeks worth of content. We would have been like, oh, Delta, that world's best airline. But
yeah, exactly. They are the world's best airline. You heard it here. Anyway, back to the other world's best airline, Lufthansa and Lufthansa Group.
Yeah.
I just think it's very sad, besides the whole Air Dolomiti thing, to see ITA be bought up by Lufthansa Group. Because we've spoken about this before. Lufthansa, Karstensspor love to sort of remove a lot of the soul from airlines.
Yeah, that's my worry.
ITA, I flew them in 2024 last year. They weren't my favorite airline ever, but obviously they have a strong Italian flair, and especially Italians I know love ITA Airways. So, you know, there's that. And I just feel like it's a sad development. Personally, I think it would have been nicer if Air France KLM bought them. They would have stayed in the same alliance. So this is a loss for SkyTeam flyers in Europe. Now the question is, I would imagine the next airline to buy another airline would be Air France KLM, because this leaves a hole in SkyTeam. And then we could discuss what are the potential contenders to fight off Star Alliance in continental Europe. Oneworld also needs to step it up. We've said this before, but the fact that Oneworld still has no presence.
Tell them, Dan.
The fact that Oneworld still has no presence in the sort of center of Europe. You have the outskirts of Spain and Finland and the UK.
Yeah.
So we need a Oneworld airline. Which airlines are allianceless? We have Condor, which doesn't provide much inter-European connectivity, but it is an option that I would welcome any airline to Oneworld at this point.
I don't want Condor. I'm uncomfortable with the name.
No, I want Condor. You heard it here. What else is there? There is, we spoke about this, EasyJet.
Silence on the podcast.
Didn't we talk about EasyJet?
I mean, I don't see it fitting. I think EasyJet, even EasyJet have kind of struggled over recent years in aligning if they want to be the kind of business, frequent flyer, second home airline, or if they're going to be more like TUI and Jet2 and be the holiday airline and everyone's on a holiday and booking an EasyJet hotel with it and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I think they've struggled there. I don't see Oneworld opening their arms up to anything like that anytime soon.
Lufthansa Group needs to keep its hands off TAP Portugal. Stay away. Wow.
My next point was going to be that we know that everyone is kind of circling TAP Air Portugal as one of the airlines that doesn't really belong to those big European conglomerates. Goodness, why did I just struggle with that? It's only a matter of time until the airline is going to be swooped up and picked up by any of the big
and
guys.
You know what? There's only one logical group to buy it, which is the group you forgot, Air France KLM. Because we already have a big presence from Oneworld there in southwestern Europe. Lufthansa Group is big enough. They need to stop now. Yeah.
My worry about Lufthansa Group is similar to yours, which is the worry of like the standardization, right? They admit that almost every airline in the Lufthansa Group ends up being exactly the same, and airlines have to battle to keep their sense of identity and brand. They have to battle their own board, the Frankfurt-based board, to keep that. We've spoken before about Swiss having to do all it could to protect the Swissness of the brand, about them wanting to just shut down Brussels Airlines and have it as Lufthansa in Belgium, and Brussels being really upset about it and the long history as one of the oldest airlines in the world. And I worry with ITA. ITA has had some decent funding pumped into the airline over the last like year and a half or so, and it's got its situation situated with like 321s, with nice lie flats,
A220s. And a sense of,
the new liveries, the A220s. It has that Italian flair. Bring Italian flair to Karsten's boardroom and we know what happens, right? They end up with something navy blue, something standardized, something where you start hearing Meine Damen und Herren in your ear and you don't hear the actual, you know, the brand and the feeling of the country you're on. So it's a worry.
It is. And I was just thinking, we give IAG and British Airways a lot of flack on the podcast. But is that the right word? It sounded so wrong coming out of my mouth. It is flack.
No, that
right?
was right. Yeah. I was surprised to hear you speak such UK
Oh, really? Lingo,
but okay. Yeah, flack. Yeah. Yeah.
We do.
I give you flack all the time. That's,
you
that's,
do. Thanks yeah? for that. Yeah. So as much as we like to give them flack, they are the only airline group in Europe that doesn't use their dominant position to charge ridiculous fares. If you look at British Airways, you look at Iberia, you look at Aer Lingus, they often have one-way fares to their hub cities for 50, 60 pounds, 60, 70 dollars. Yeah. Try to find a fare like that on Air France KLM or any Lufthansa group airline. Lufthansa's prices on especially Swiss and Lufthansa are outrageous for what you're getting.
Do you know, completely. every time I see that the upcoming flight I'm on, let's say it's a work trip, right? So I can see how much the ticket has cost. But then I just go on to check how much, you know, the rest of the plane are paying. And I'm like, what? 380 euros to go from, you know, Hamburg to Frankfurt or from, you know, Vienna to Munich. And I'm wondering how on earth any normal person is affording for such a short journey. And you're right. In a sense, IAG do bless us with the ability to, for example, if you're going from Madrid to London, right? Many people who are in the interest of wanting to be budget conscious, saving money and maximizing their efficiency with their finances would automatically think of a low-cost carrier. And I often encourage them that if you are booking an EasyJet flight and then you're adding luggage and then you're adding a seat and blah, 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 well, you don't need to do any of that because it's actually cheaper to just do a full fare British Airways 49 euro flight, something like that, which exists. I just don't see that on the Lufthansa counterparts. You're absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head. That extends across all their brands. And IAG are not obsessed with the idea of one brand, right?
Yes.
So for example, British Airways is not a replica of Iberia, right? And Aer Lingus is as Irish as it was prior to IAG ever touching it.
Yeah.
And I think that is also something that we can respect.
I mean, that's the thing that Air France KLM at least also respect the different brands of the airlines coming in. But they charge the same ridiculous fares. Like you want to go from anywhere to just Amsterdam or just Paris on Air France or KLM, you're screwed. It's going to be outrageous. But meanwhile, you can fly BA from London to Amsterdam for very, very cheap. And I mean, forget about a route like between the hub cities of Lufthansa Group Airlines, like between Frankfurt and Zurich or between Munich and Brussels.
The flight between Zurich and Frankfurt is the cost of going to Singapore.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just absolutely crazy. This is it's just sad news, but ITA Airways was also profitable on its own in 2023, I guess now. Which is, I mean, that's an achievement for an Italian airline.
I believe they'll announce the same for 2024. I think that's the result's not out, but it is an achievement. And that's why I also think it's a pretty good deal on the Lufthansa side, but we shall see how this plays out. We're going to be keeping an eye on them, holding them to account, and checking out the real backstory to the origins of Lufthansa's first slogan, which was "Nonstop Dan, Nonstop You." That's where he got it from. Anyway, let's move to Q&A.
Let's do it. All right, so first question. Now we're getting into questions from December. So guys, feel free to DM us new questions for the new year. Mart, and by the way, sorry if we didn't get to your question last year. We always appreciate you guys sending them in.
Send it again.
So here Mark asks, hey, an idea for the next podcast. What is your experience with early check-in? I always have the wildest experiences from paying extra for 3 hours early to no problemo, here is a free upgrade. Also, that's it. Interesting. I've never heard of the concept of having to pay extra to check in early. Do you know about this?
Which airline did he say?
He didn't say. So
he didn't. Okay. There are some carriers, but I think more on the low cost side that you can pay to arrive the evening before. I think some of the UK holiday airlines do that, but I'm not sure about rest of the world. Usually it's an option almost an unwritten option where if you are flying early morning, you're actually able to check in at any time from around 12, sometimes even within the 24-hour window, you're able to do that online check-in. The physical check-in at the airport. Yeah, and that works out well when you are, for example, staying at the airport or you live nearby or you just want to get rid of your 10 bags if you're traveling heavy. So it's good. Have you done this? Do you do this?
No, I'm not the one to check in early, but I have been faced with the situation many times where they don't let you check in because it's too early. Mm. Because let's say I've checked out of a hotel, so I want to leave my bag at check-in and then do whatever. I think that's just such a bad policy, and the airports should be incentivizing airlines to make people check in as early as possible, actually with almost a financial reward, because the longer someone spends in the terminal, the more they're going to spend money in the terminal. So the airline wins. If someone comes to Heathrow at 8 a.m. for their 3 p.m. flight, that should be good. Of course, that can lead to a capacity problem, but I've never faced this problem at a big hub airport in the West. But in Asia, for example, in India, I've faced this situation every time where if you arrive, I think it's depending on the flight, 2 or 3 hours before, they just won't let you do it. So you have to wait in luggage claim until they open. And back in the day when I would do really rough review trips, there was one time I had to wait for like 5 or 6 hours in the check-in area in Delhi because they wouldn't let me check in after a red eye when I was expecting to be able to go airside and sleep in the lounge. So
yeah,
that's not good. But of course, there are airports that encourage it, like Singapore Changi, for example, which has early check-in desks in the Jewel. So you can actually, while you're in the mall, you can check your bags in without even having to enter the terminal, spend all day in the shopping mall, buying stuff, eating, getting a massage, and then go to the airport, which is awesome. Or you have the likes of Emirates, which has several city check-in counters throughout Dubai, and or the option to do at-home check-in where you order someone to come to your house, they take your bags, and then you head to the airport at a later time in premium cabins.
And when they take your bags, they give you your boarding pass, so you are just free to arrive to the airport and go straight through. That's the home check-in service. That, and also Cathay Pacific, I know they've resumed the city check-in in Hong Kong. So it's definitely a more Asia thing, I think, than the... than in Europe. But I wonder if that's something that will ever catch on. I mean, for this is not anything new. For years and years, this decades, this has existed. It's funny, for example, I just couldn't imagine British Airways having a city check-in in central London.
No.
It's weird, isn't it? You just know that it wouldn't, I don't know, that you'd arrive to the terminal before your bags did. And then it's like, you know, it would just be stuck on that M4 or whatever. So
Then there's the likes of, you know, in New York, they have Blade, this helicopter service to get you to the airport.
Yes.
The crazy thing about something like that is that you're not allowed to bring any checked luggage in the helicopter. Mm. So if you have checked luggage, you need to send it in a car separately to the airport, I guess to Blade's office or something. I've never done Blade because I always have checked bags when I'm going to the US. But that to me is like, I guess it shows the challenges in some cities figuring out how to do that logistically in an efficient way, but
and that's why we see it in the cities that are efficient and known like for Singapore, their efficiency, and like Singapore and Hong Kong and others. So that's really true. We've got a comment here from Mohammed, who wrote in after listening to last week's episode where we were discussing the heavy departure taxes from Pakistan, and he says, "Hi Alex, you guys were talking about the departure tax from Pakistan. It technically does not apply to any PIA flights, as we discussed that it did, because they are not actually classified as premium business class cabins, but are instead considered executive economy cabins in order to get around that little loophole instigated by the state. If they did declare it as a business class, those taxes would absolutely apply to them. So basically, they screw the foreign carriers from coming in and out with really high taxation on premium cabins, but they kind of pretend that their business class is, this is not business class, this is executive economy." Well, something that both you and I realized after Mohammed had been in touch with us, but grateful for the shared anecdote. It's a learning process, and you're absolutely right. Thank you, Mohammed, for that.
And what a scam. I think the criteria should be, if you go on Google Flights and you search for business class, does Pakistan International appear under business class? If they do,
yes,
it's business class. If that fare appears under economy class, fine, by all means. But then they're going to miss out on all the people that actually want to book business. So that's just crazy. Yeah. And of course, foreign airlines can't do the same thing because it would confuse the heck out of their passengers. If you book business, or let's say you book Emirates first to or from the US to Pakistan, yeah, and then your leg from Dubai to Pakistan is like economy first. That wouldn't
just
be
because
so
you
nice.
Slap the economy word in front of it. We have another question here from Q Aviation. He says, hope you are doing well. I really enjoy the on-air podcast. It's always spot on. Quick question. Do you think Emirates will ever resume flights to Doha? He says, it's curious how all the other UAE carriers fly there, but Emirates doesn't. And almost, if not all of the GCC carriers now operate to Doha. There has to be a reason behind this decision, maybe something politically. Would love to hear back from you. So remember that Emirates doesn't fly here, but Emirates' little sister, Fly Dubai, does fly to Doha. And that's been the case ever since the resumption of diplomatic ties following the blockade that we have spoke extensively about in the podcast before. If you haven't, go and find the episode back where we discussed it. Why do I think Emirates is not here and Fly Dubai is there demand sufficient enough for Emirates to fly between Doha and Dubai? Absolutely. Pre-blockade, there were dozens of A380s operating this 20-minute flight constantly throughout the day. Sometimes it was twice in an hour. Is it something political as to why Emirates doesn't send Emirates and instead kind of Fly Dubai does it? Yeah, but it's on the Emirati side. So our understanding is that in Qatar now has, for example, Hamad International Airport has, I think, categorically the most number of oneworld airlines operating to any hub globally. Everyone from Japan Airlines to Finnair, loads of Chinese carriers, they're all here. It's a portfolio that has extended massively. Then you've got also all these kind of unusual airlines that fly here. You have flights from not even just the national carrier, but secondary airlines in Iran that operate to Doha.
Airlines too.
A lot of Chinese carriers. Garuda now are flying here.
Yeah.
You have flights from Syria, even prior to what happened over recent weeks, operating here, Cham Wings and other carriers. Yemenia still come to Doha. I don't know how you buy the flight tickets because there's no online resources for that. But you think you have to go to a certain agent. Yeah, certain agent. But anyway, the message I'm trying to bring home is that the airport, Hamad International Airport, is definitely open for business. It is an airport that now has loads of foreign carriers, of which if Emirates wanted to be one of them, I know that they would be welcome with open arms. I think just Emirates hasn't made that move yet ever since the blockade finished, and they're kind of satisfied with Fly Dubai doing it in an unnoticed capacity.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like it's a pride thing on Emirates' part. There's, you know, something holding them back, which is a shame, but Qatar Airways flies a lot to Dubai, and obviously not as much as they did pre-blockade, but still.
Yeah.
If you combine Sharjah and Dubai and Abu Dhabi, there's quite a lot of capacity there in addition to the other airlines. By the way, you mentioned something that we haven't spoken about on the podcast, which is massive news. The resumption of international airline flights to Syria.
Yes, to Syria. Yes.
Do you want to tell us about Qatar?
Yeah, so Qatar flying there, Turkish Airlines have announced that they're about to start. They're starting shortly. Royal Jordanian have announced their return to Damascus. This is all since the fall of the Assad regime. And now with the new leader in Syria, there are many countries restoring their full diplomatic ties with Syria, which includes the resumption of air travel. Qatar Airways were the first international airline, the first airline outside of Syria to begin flying. They operate around three times a week with an Airbus A330. Those flights have been underway now for a good week or so, 10 days. Turkish Airlines, as I said, about to start. Ultimately, Syria, for now, is coming back online on the air travel map, which is obviously very heartwarming for those that need to be able to fly there to reconnect with family. Some of the footage that we saw post that first flight.
Yeah.
Families crying, saying that they haven't seen their relatives in 10, 15 years. They haven't been back to their homes. That they you know, air travel is more than just a business, right? When it comes to this, yeah. It is a vital connection. And
but
in terms of increasing the connection, it's good news.
Yeah, it is. It is. One thing that frustrated me about some of the reports, most of the reporting got it wrong. And the way it was framed was wrong, because a lot of people said, this is the resumption of international flights to Syria.
No.
It's the resumption of international airlines. There have been flights to and from Correct. Syria this whole time. So you see yeah. people hopping off the Qatar Airways plane, the first international airline to serve Damascus, now crying, hugging their relative. It's like, this is beautiful, but you could have flown yesterday on Cham wings. Like, well, you just didn't want to fly them.
Look, and there are reasons why many didn't want to fly under the Assad regime,
yeah.
didn't feel they could enter Damascus, didn't feel they could fly on a Syrian carrier. Yeah. So that's the real picture. It's
yeah.
not just because they were looking at Cham wings and being like, do you guys have decent seat recline? It wasn't
exactly. Yeah, so the emotion was more the fall of the regime and not necessarily like, yeah. oh my God, there's flights again. And I yeah. do find it interesting that both Turkish and Qatar are launching 3 weekly flights on an A330 rather than, let's say, going daily on an A320. Do you know why that might be?
I had understood that it was slow and steady, a gradual assessment of how the route was going to perform, knowing that there is going to be sufficient demand, justifying the need for an A330, but also knowing that there may need to be breathing room in between flights to be able to continue to assess the situation and ensure the stability continues, thus not launching daily, right?
Yeah.
So that you don't have to do those last minute things. So it's kind of, it's gradual, yet the 330 is required because they know that the demand is there and therefore the capacity is required.
Okay, interesting. Maybe also cargo is a part of that equation, wanting to bring cargo to and from Syria. But
yeah, but there's a few questions there as to what can be carried. And, you know, there's in this kind of post-Assad era and as they kind of unbundle everything. So cargo, I know, is not playing the biggest role yet, but may going forward.
So now the question is, well, how many airlines will we see return to Syrian airspace? I guess that will be a gradual assessment. Yeah. But of course, we had Qatar Airways a couple of years ago using it temporarily, but then they stopped again. And it's mainly Middle East airlines that uses it now out of the non-Syrian airlines. But of course, any airspace that can reopen is incredibly valuable. So hopefully we can see airlines start to safely use Syrian airspace again.
And I think that's what we will see. I think that's what we'll see. And you know what? We've answered a couple of questions there. I had two questions. One from a guy called Dan, who ironically wasn't you, and also T, but doesn't say the name, both about Syria. So hopefully we've answered both of your questions, guys. There is a quick one. Oh, let's end on this one. Points to the Moon says, speaking of irrational behavior related to travel and points, can I hear everyone else's, including Dan and Alex? He said, I'll go first. Next month, I need to go to Guangzhou from Minneapolis and back. How? Goodness, Minneapolis. Sorry, here we go. So Minneapolis, Dallas, Doha, Guangzhou, Taipei, Bangkok, Amsterdam, Chicago, Minneapolis. Okay, I just read that only via airport codes, right? So MSP, DFW, DOH, CAN, TPE, BKK, AMS, ORD, MSP again. So the return alone will take 96 hours by design and include a 4-hour bike ride, a 3-star restaurant, two airport hotels, plus a capsule and a night market and a partridge in a pear tree. The really bad part is possibly being stranded in Chicago for 6 hours without a lounge. That sounds exhausting.
Yeah.
You used to do crazy shit like this. I haven't.
Yeah, back when I was young.
Wild and... Without a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're both quite rational, which makes for boring stories when it comes to frequent flyer status these days. Last year, I will say I spent like $900 on sustainable aviation fuel, which feels like a good thing to do with Air France KLM. But the bonus was that I got like 100 XPs or something, which we were talking about last year, is the equivalent to their tier points, which got me up to Air France Platinum, which is what I wanted to be able to redeem for La Première. So it's a long, complicated way to get there. But
I thought you were saying, speaking of irrational, last year I spent $900 on sustainable aviation fuel. As if that was your irrational part.
I know.
But look, better to spend it on SAF than to spend it on carbon offsetting.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was $900 for one transatlantic flight was obviously a lot to spend. Yeah. That's why, like, it was kind of irrational in that sense, but at least it was something quite good I was doing as well and getting status definitely out of it. So
definitely you're a do-gooder, Dan. You thank are a do-gooder. And we're happy to have you here on the podcast as our special host, guest host, week in, week out. It's genuinely a pleasure. The listeners and I,
you and your split personalities.
We will wrap up and we'll continue this conversation. As Dan said, guys, we welcome your questions for next week because we've gone through quite a lot of the backlog, but we're ready to tackle your new challenges, your new questions, your new anecdotes for the new year. So do get in touch with us via the usual platforms. It's best usually via Instagram because, neither of us are. Well, I'm not on TikTok. I don't even have the app. And Dan, you're on it, aren't you?
I love TikTok, but
do you have access? You know.
Well, yeah. And also, I think access has been restored in the US now. Well, okay. Yeah, by the time this episode goes live, things can change by the hours. So we'll have to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
We might, TikTok might not even exist anywhere by the time this episode goes up.
Maybe perhaps, guys, you can follow us on Vine or connect with us on MySpace or something like that.
Oh my gosh, I loved Vine. Did you use Vine?
Vine was great. I know. Yes, yes.
The thing is, if you had been on TikTok, you would have also loved TikTok. TikTok is so much better than Instagram Reels. Incomparable. So
I'm glad I don't have it. There are already enough hours a day that Instagram consumes and other apps. I can't add another into the mix.
Exactly. But
looking forward to speaking with you again next week. Thank you for your company and thank you guys for listening.
Thank you. We'll see you all next week on air. Bye-bye.
Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app. Get tender USDA Choice boneless chuck roast or stew meat for $6.99 a pound. Then get 2-liter bottles of Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $1.49 each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.